Is Europe facing a democracy crisis? And what are its roots? With far-right parties gaining ground, we ask where next for our troubled continent. Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper from the LSE. This podcast is brought to you from Vienna, where the centre-right, having swung wildly in a populist direction, have won Sunday's general election.
Now Sebastian Kurz looks set to retake power in Austria.
As Europe looks set for more difficult times ahead, I caught up with two of our regular guests. Niccolò Milanese is from European Alternatives and the co-author of Citizens of Nowhere. I also spoke to Ruth Bodak, a leading public intellectual, emeritus professor, and staunch critic of the European far right. To feed back to us on today's podcast, you can contact us on podcast@anothereurope.org or find us on Twitter @another_Europe. Hope you enjoy it. Hey Niccolò, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, thanks for having me. In a different city this time.
In Vienna, yeah, here we are in the IWM library. Lovely to be here. So, look, let's start with a big open question that I know you will like as a political philosopher. What's the current state of democracy in Europe? And can you give me your best Twitter-length answer to this question?
I'm rubbish at Twitter, but I think that I would say that democracy is in a process of metamorphosis, and it's up to us to see whether it's going to become something beautiful or something very ugly. Is that a Twitter length?
That is actually a Twitter length answer. Go. Flesh that out a bit, and what's the metamorphosis?
Well, I think there's a couple of important elements to that. One is that democracy is never a kind of steady state. It's something that over its history has changed between various kinds of regimes. So no one is pretending that we live in the same kind of democracy as was the case in ancient Athens, for example. So there can be different forms of democracy. The second element is that democracy is always going to be, to a certain extent, contested with different visions of what democracy is going to look like. But the fact that there's different kinds of democracy doesn't mean that some kinds are not better than others. And it also doesn't mean that there's no difference between democracy and tyranny or autocracy. So we need to be able to develop a kind of subtle and differentiated picture of democracy, and then also understand that democracy is a different regime from other kinds of regimes. Today, in contemporary Europe, it's clear that democracy is under a kind of attack, but it's under attack from people who also claim to be Democrats. But the kind of democracy that they want to promote is one that has some similarities to what John Stuart Mill called tyranny of the majority, has some similarities with what previously was totalitarianism, has some similarities with forms of fascism. And so it's a very ugly kind of democracy indeed. But at the same time, there is this emergence of what seems to be a different way of doing democracy, or new aspirations for democracy. The most obvious of those symbols, and in some way the easiest, is Fridays for Future.
Protests against climate change in action have become a regular Friday fixture. They started after the Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg staged her school strike in August last year. They've now grown to become a global phenomenon.
Across Europe, there are people who are organising, calling out for a kind of renewal in our democratic systems, but that renewal hasn't fully come about yet. So that's a little bit what I was trying to capture in my Twitter message.
Yeah. And I suppose when people talk, there's this buzzword about illiberal democracy. Here at the IWM, there's a seminar every few days looking at the rise of illiberal democracy in Europe. Like, that raises a question around two different facets of what we've taken to mean by democracy in the 21st century. On the one hand, a commitment to liberal human rights, and the belief that liberal human rights are fundamental. And that relates to 1968 and after, and liberation movements and a whole package of stuff. And on the other level, the idea of representative political institutions. And illiberal Democrats, like Viktor Orban, who's gone a long way to pioneer this ideological concept, I suppose, and put it into practice in Hungarian governance. He says that he's for representative democracy, but he's against human rights and liberalism.
Yes, I think I wouldn't put the genealogy quite in the way that you put it. I mean, I think that in the 19th century, liberal nationalism was a kind of coherent position, and that many of the people who were involved in building of nation states were doing it precisely in the name of liberal values and the rights of citizens. Why not the rights of citizens and the rights of man? What's happened over the 20th century is we've understood, if you like, that the state can be one of the worst enemies of human rights, and so human rights have become detached from the nation state. At the same time, there's no completely alternative political ordering. We don't live in a global state or an international state which would directly guarantee our human rights. So there's a kind of tension there which is being exploited by people like Orban. There's a tension around what you could see as the contradiction between the rights of the citizen and the rights of man. What do you do when there's a conflict between, or there appears to be a conflict between the rights of the citizen and the human rights? And so Orban's wanting to say, well, I'm on the side of my citizens, our nation, against the human rights claims. And this kind of ambiguity is constantly exploited by right-wing populists and authoritarians, whether they're called Theresa May or Viktor Orban. That's exactly the discourse of, if you believe you're citizens of the world, you're citizens of nowhere. So I think that together with that has gone a kind of collapse of the future as a perspective. If you look at 19th century liberal state building, it's with a philosophy of history which extends into the future quite a long way, and this idea of progress and so on. And surely part of the phenomenon of the new right is this kind of apocalyptic imaginary that the future is almost absent, you know, every decision needs to be taken now, and that can lead to somehow the most monstrous decisions appearing justified.
That's very interesting. And I guess there's so much there in terms of the right-wing populism that animated Brexit, that animates Trump. It doesn't have a very strong story around, well, what does our society look like in 15 years, 20 years? I suppose you do get it in some, I guess Bannon is quite a big thinker of the new alt-right, and basically he sees a collapse of civilizations into a series of warring entities in which you need to defend white Western space. I wouldn't even say hegemony. I'm not even sure. It's almost like a post-imperial fascism. It's more that you just need to keep all of these non-white peoples out of your society and defend what you have rather than expand imperially. But that does seem to animate a lot of the far right in Europe as well. I mean, here in Austria, I mean, we have the Freedom Party openly taking up notions that there's a conspiracy to carry out a replacement of white Christian populations in Europe by Muslims and things like this. These have become quite normal in many European political discourses.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a debate about how much a liberal democracy, if you want to take the term seriously, is authentically inspired by Christianity. Some of the illiberal leaders, at least in Europe, and obviously it doesn't work when you go to India, but at least in Europe, want to claim that they are the authentic Christian right or Christian democrats. And part of that is just trying to kind of cover over their Islamophobia or give themselves a sense of legitimacy. But I do think that the temporality of Christianity and these kinds of visions of a war of the peoples that is coming, a sort of apocalyptic imaginary of replacement, this is Christian in inspiration. And so I think there is a sense there that there's a kind of Christian illiberalism, and that has its historical precedence. And it would be too simplistic to try and just discount all of the theological dimension of this. There's a deep theological debate about the nature of modernity, which these movements are plugging into. And there's very powerful spiritual, cultural resources that they can draw on. And that's surely part of the reason why they're able to capture attention, capture the imagination in a much stronger way than their opponents, typically, who can draw on the imagery of technocracy and normalcy, which is by no means as exciting.
Nineteenth century liberal constitutionalism sort of became connected to nationalism. 21st century liberal constitutionalism as becoming disconnected from nationalism. And my question is around, I guess, the differences in national experience that are producing this common thing. So I know you live in France. I mean, liberalism, bit of a dirty word there. Maybe you could say something about that. Central and Eastern Europe, liberalism is associated with structural adjustment in the 1990s, power stations closing down, blackouts, food shortages. You know, it became a dirty word for those reasons that the nationalists have really effectively latched onto. I don't know how universal it is, but it seems to be a part of this quite complicated picture, this separation of liberalism and democracy.
Yes, and it seems astonishing now already that people thought that 89 had brought the end, a period of history, or brought to the end the whole of history, because it seems like the 20th century left us with all kinds of unresolved tensions, and this tension between human rights and civic rights is one of them, and this diversity of national experiences and national trajectories is another. Now, you asked me about France, and I think that it's true that liberalism is sort of like a dirty word because it's too associated with the United States of America, but that's also to do with the rivalry of revolutionaries. I mean, the America wants to claim its revolution and France wants to claim its revolution as the one that really introduced modern politics. I think that really in France you can take republicanism and appeals to the republic as a replacement for appeals to liberalism. I mean, it's this tradition of republican liberty that is the core of the liberal doctrine, even if it's not called that. In France, what to say about the disconnect between universals and particulars, which Europe is kind of the epicenter of, and Europe in all of its ambiguities has always been at once something that is universal with apparently universal pretensions, which at some point have been imperial, and also the highly particular, the minutely particular, the fascination with every particular difference. You could read the whole history of Europe, let alone the European Union, in those terms, and the diversity of experience between a place like France, the universal nation by excellence, and the particularisms of Central and Eastern Europe. This is what's being played out these days.
And how does Britain fit into this picture? Lots of people will look at, quite rightly, we've covered it on several episodes of this show, the rule of law crisis in Britain, Boris Johnson's increasing invoking of Orban-like language, conflict with the judiciary. I mean, this sounds like it's ringing a lot of alarm bells in terms of stuff we've seen in other European countries. It's also probably full of its own very specific peculiars that means that it's not quite the same thing as we see in other places.
Yes, it's true that the rest of the Europeans have had great difficulty understanding what's going on in the UK, perhaps the same difficulty as all of the rest of us, but in particular because they're not sure how literally to take the kind of things that are described. How literally you should take Boris Johnson in anything that he says is somehow an unanswerable question. It's always half in jest and half serious, even if in recent days the threats of violence on the streets sound more and more directly like threats with no element of jest left in them. But terms like rule of law crisis or constitutional crisis are terms which describe well, or potentially describe well, what happens in mainland Europe where there is a constitution. I was going to say constitutional Europe. And where the rule of law is a kind of sacrosanct and overarching element of what it means to be protecting democracy. Trying to apply those terms in the UK context with its insistence on the place of custom and manners and good behaviour is problematic. It's not a fully adequate way of trying to describe what's going on. And so you can easily, I think, overestimate the degree of threat or collapse. I mean, how can there be a constitutional crisis when there's not a written constitution? It sounds like the constitution is about to fall down, but then you say, but the constitution is not really written anywhere. It's in people's behaviours, and people's behaviours still have some normative power. I mean, Boris Johnson is fighting against the normative behaviours of still large parts of British society, which are resisting. I mean, you saw them outside the Parliament resisting, saying this is a coup. You see them in the courts It's still newspapers that have this normative. So it does have its specificities. I think that something which is really underestimated in the UK, but important to the Brexit situation, is that Britain now for centuries has played out its politics in an international scene to a much greater extent than some other countries, because it was such a globalized power. And so the way that it is perceived and the way that it mobilizes international attention is very important in terms of what actually ends up happening. So the politics is not purely domestic, and somehow Boris Johnson is the instantiation of this spectacular, attention-grabbing, internationalized politics. And I have to say that the opposition to him is by no means as good at capturing this international attention and mobilizing it as a domestic force.
He's very good at attention-grabbing. I think this is the symmetry between Trump and Johnson, is that there's this love of the spectacular. You say something shocking, you dominate the news cycle with your shocking statement, and you cohere your support base. What I find interesting about it compared to Margaret Thatcher is that with Thatcher, you got a real sense from her speeches and interviews that she wanted to change how people think. It was a real attempt at winning hegemony in the true sense of leading British society and creating a new cultural way of being British that was anti-union, that was anti the socialist state and was pro-hard work. And I've been rereading some of her speeches and interviews this week, and it really flows out of every word. You know, it's like a political philosophy about aggressive individualism and you can get ahead. And for all their very ideological hardline nationalism and racism that in both cases, Trump and Johnson, for example, the Muslim women as letterboxes with Johnson, Trump, the Muslim ban, you don't really get the feeling that they're trying to change how people think. You more get the feeling they're instrumentalizing something that's there already, and they see as gaining political capital from instrumentalizing the racism that never went away and giving it a much more explicit public expression and therefore legitimacy in the UK.
Yeah, I'm less sure about that when it comes to Trump. I mean, I definitely agree that it's difficult to imagine either of them carrying around a book in their bag, like Margaret Thatcher famously had Hayek in her handbag and kind of pulled it out strategically every so often. It's clear that they're not thinkers in that sense, and they also don't need to take themselves so seriously and claim that kind of intellectual legitimacy and sense of project. I think that Boris Johnson is interested in power and is thoroughly malleable. I mean, everything about him suggests that. The question is perhaps more about whether those people who are behind him and behind the Brexit project in general have a clear ideological vision that they want to carry out. I think that there are elements there. So with Trump, I think that this kind of cult of celebrity and culture of immediacy and attention, this is not an intellectual ideology, but it's still a kind of vision of what the good life is. I'm sure that Donald Trump has a vision of what the good life is. It's a monstrous vision, if you ask me, but I think he believes in it.
The case that refutes what I said really strongly, potentially, is his UN speech. Do you remember that one?
Mm.
I mean, it was a complete nationalist tirade against globalism and against everything the global elite stood for. So in that sense, it's a bid for a hegemonic shift in how the world organises itself. Any final thoughts as we're drawing to a close?
I think that the most challenging thing for those of us who are engaged in political activism these days is to appreciate the urgency of the moment, but also manage to maintain a temporal horizon in front of ourselves. And so managing to keep in our minds the simultaneous sense that it's urgent, but there is time. Because this is what the autocrats or the illiberal democrats and so on all around us want to take away, the idea that there is time, and it's one of the most important things for us to fight for.
Could you just flesh that out a little bit? So the autocrats want to take away the belief in the possibility of change.
the belief in the possibility of change, but also in the belief that it's possible to build anything, the belief that it's possible to build a better society or to build a better democracy. And there's this kind of cynical claim that it's all really a sham. I mean, one of the things that people say that Putin is most motivated to promote abroad is the idea that somehow they might pretend to be Democrats committed to human rights in the West, but it's all really a sham. And there's this kind of element of that in the autocratic attacks on democracy all around. It's just that it's not possible to build a better society, and so we should just kind of protect what we have, and we don't need to worry about seeming to be moral, because in the end everybody's a hypocrite. So that it's possible to build a better society, and also that doing such a thing will take time, something that is constructed over years and over generations. And the illiberals would like to say that there is no time, and so it's every person for himself and every people for themselves.
Mm. Well, thanks so much for talking to me. That was fantastic as ever. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much.
It won't be the last time.
I'm looking forward to the next time.
From the IWM, I popped on the Underground to meet Ruth Vodak for a cup of coffee and take stock of the current state of far-right politics in Austria. So Ruth, welcome back to the show. Not the first time you've been on the Another Europe podcast, so we've got two of our regular guests back on today's show here in beautiful Vienna. So earlier I was just talking to Niccolò Milanese about picture across the rest of Europe, what's going on generally, the rise of the far right and the real push to create, I guess, a Europe of nation states. And we're unpicking a bit this term illiberal democracy that's used a lot. But maybe we could start here by zoning in on what's happened in Austria specifically. We've just had the big Austrian elections. And what are your first thoughts?
Well, I think that the phenomenon, the Austrian election yesterday, is more complex. And international media don't really see the Austrian situation in its complexity. So, yes, it's right. The extreme right lost yesterday. They lost not so much because of Ibiza. And I guess we will talk a bit more about the Ibiza scandal, which caused the fall of this government on May 18, but they actually failed and lost a lot of votes because of last week's scandal, which hasn't really been picked up by the international media and which seems to have disturbed and irritated extreme right voters much more than Ibiza. The scandal last week was about corruption, and it was about the former leader of the FPÖ, Hatzi Strache, having possibly, this or allegedly, forged receipts and having taken money from the party and having received an expense account of over 40,000 euros per month, which is, of course, unbelievable for a party representing the small man and the small woman on the street. This scandal only struck last week. That means 5 days before the election, that was leaked to the media. A former bodyguard of Hatzi Strache leaked this information, was then taken to court and obviously interrogated, and has told a long story which we don't know in all details as yet. And the Freedom Party is now investigating this. So they haven't been able to actually refute that, and they haven't been able to really see if the accusations are right or wrong. But the media played it up to an enormous scandal last week. And the consequences of this was that about 500,000 or more voters from the FPÖ, almost a half of their voters, either stayed home or went to the ÖVP. Without this happening, like 2 weeks ago, the FPÖ stood at 20 or 21%, And it wasn't clear if they would come second place or third, so if they would overtake the Social Democrats or not. So this last week is salient. And it's interesting that the international media haven't picked up on this.
So could you just outline exactly what the Ibiza scandal is?
The Ibiza scandal, which was secretly staged and videotaped meeting of Hatzi Strache and his then sort of compagnon and the vice mayor of Vienna and the whip in the parliament, Gudenus, met niece of a Russian oligarch on Ibiza, that's an island, a sort of playboy jet set island where Strache has always had his holidays. And Strache was tape recorded and videotaped, basically selling out Austria, promising to help this niece, so-called niece, to buy the biggest tabloid, to give away big construction projects, to even sell and privatize water, and so forth. And all that in a seven-hour session with lots of alcohol, possibly drugs, and champagne, and vodka, and so forth. And that caused an enormous scandal, as it should, and Strache had to resign, and then things took their course, and the government received a non-confidence vote.
And that's how we got to these
elections. And that's how we got to this election. Now, Ibiza itself was then constructed as for the Freedom Party. This can happen to everybody. Everybody gets drunk once in a while. Everybody makes a mistake once in a while. There was a conspiracy to take them down. The conspiracy was probably managed by Soros or Mossad or some Jews in some world conspiracy. And Strache was constructed as a victim. And Kurz, who had invited Strache to his government and basically has a 80% overlap with Strache's and the Freedom Party's program, also constructed himself as a victim of the Freedom Party, a victim, and Ibiza had, as all the opinion polls show, almost no consequences, which is astounding internationally, and I have been asked by many friends, colleagues, journalists, how can that be? Both parties were very clever in sort of redefining the situation, reframing the situation in different ways. But both were guilty in different ways. But the scandal last week really caused the FPÖ to fall, because that struck at the core. Somebody getting more than 40,000 euro a month for expenses in a party which stands for the workers, for the poor, for the true Austrians, for the Heimat, and not for the rich. That was too much. And as the person, the one political scientist who in the whole media circus which we were confronted with the entire August and September, who explains politics to the Austrian audience basically almost every day after some media debate, very rightly said yesterday, summing up what this means for any outcome of this election now, that Kurz, who overlaps in his program to 80% with the Freedom Party and can thus legitimately be called right-wing populist, he's not a nativist, but certainly a nationalist, and most certainly neoliberal, and most certainly very conservative in many, many political fields and agenda, and especially in migration issues. And the Green Party, who are absolutely the opposite, both of these parties will have immense difficulties in explaining a potential coalition to their electorate. Because Kurz got 300,000 plus voters from the FPÖ, how would he explain going soft on migration? and the Green Party got an enormous amount, a comeback with many voters of the Social Democrats, and how would they explain suddenly going strict on migration or letting loose on education or on some core projects of the Greens, who are certainly in the left spectrum? So it seems like a very strange situation which we are now confronted with.
So from your description, you think you're very sceptical that the Greens and Kurz will now be able to strike a coalition agreement. I've only been in Vienna just over 24 hours and spoken to colleagues at the IWM, and I seem to have got a different prediction of what's going to happen in terms of these coalition talks from every single person I've spoken to. Some people who voted Green, very optimistic that the Greens would go into coalition with Kurz, not because they think that will be good, they just think that's the least worst option and therefore the best for Austria. Another person said, yeah, it will be a disaster for the Greens, but it's probably good for Austria. Another person agreed with you and said they won't be able to strike a coalition agreement because there's just too much difference between them, and it'll probably again points back to an FPÖ-ÖFP coalition agreement like the one we've just had before, so nothing has changed. So that must be a statement somehow that it's very uncertain in this situation, because all of these academics, intellectuals are just judging it in different ways.
I think that nobody knows right now, and it's very difficult to predict, and I cannot predict. But what I can say is, if you look at the various facts which we have, so journalists participated in Kurz's election campaign for several days or a week, and really showed how very well instructed Kurz behaved, almost like a robot, with the same speech everywhere, not looking at any notes because he knows it by heart, but not a context-oriented speech. It's always the same speech. It's always 20 minutes. He always does the same. He always wears the same. And basically a very photogenic person who also addresses journalists directly, asks them if they need more, if they want to take a photo, who knows them all, and is very media savvy, but very little content. Basically, three or four contents were prevalent. One was securing care for the elderly, and in that field he took over or tried to take over a principal electorate of the Social Democrats. Then very strongly migration, protecting Austria, no refugees at all, not even two would be taken again in a quota distribution. And in that sense, it's the same as the Freedom Party. The third issue was education. No changes in the education legislation, which is very important because the Green Party here and the Social Democrats have very different perspectives and proposals, and also NEOS. And
NEOS is the Liberal Party.
And the fourth basic issue was also sort of cutting expenses. So it would be more neoliberal policies, more privatization, more cutting of social care, of benefits, whatever, healthcare, etc. After the non-confidence vote...
Yeah, so this was the vote that happened, that basically brought down the Austrian government when they lost the Freedom Party from the coalition.
Basically, an interim government was composed and situated by the president. That's constitutional. These were and are excellent experts, Supreme Court judges, presidents, you name it, the best of the best. And the former government, who had MP seats, took back their seats. Kurz had the seat for the ÖVP, for Vienna. And he refused to take his seat and said he wouldn't take it. He wanted to travel through Austria. So he said, I will win back the people against the parliament.
This now, has certain echoes in British national discourses at the moment.
An absolute echo to the discourse I know from Britain right now, sort of opposing and juxtaposing parliament to the so-called people. And he did that, parliament und Volk. And his slogans were actually partly Haider slogans. The slogan, he speaks like you do, is a old Haider slogan, which interestingly both the Freedom Party took up and Kurz. So in that way, Kurz actually sort of humiliated parliament. He actually said the parliament were not the people, didn't represent the people. He would represent the people. And he juxtaposed the two, which we know from Britain, which we know from Trump, which we know from many other right-wing populist far-right leaders. And then taking up similar populist slogans again positions him very clearly where he belongs. And it's interesting that the international media didn't see that. So basically, Kurz has been campaigning since beginning of July.
It's really interesting to hear you say that, especially from an Austrian perspective, because in a way, what Kurz seems to have done is destroy Austrian consensus politics. I mean, it reminds, when from your description, yes, there are recent echoes in Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, but to go further back, I mean, if we look at someone like Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan, they both saw politics as this, like, battle of ideas to the death, really. They completely rejected consensus. You're either with me or you're against me. And, of course, Austria in the post-war period was the country of the consensus. I mean, you never went along until recently with that kind of Thatcherite approach to politics. But Kurz seems to have very much gone in that direction.
Absolutely. And in that way, already in the 18 months of that government, we have encountered and experienced a sort of subversion of parliamentary procedures, always FPÖ and ÖVP, the government. So questions were not answered. Legislation which should have been evaluated and assessed during a certain period of time, that period was shortened or it didn't happen at all. So the absolutely routines of parliament were undermined, which is why already in during these 18 months I wrote several pieces also for Open Democracy and other venues and outlets where I said this is the first step towards illiberalism. If you start undermining these routines, just the formal procedures. And also he didn't negotiate. There was no dialogue with the opposition. Also, again, very similar to what has happened in Britain. The new situation now would actually request very heavily a dialogue. Because now new coalitions will have to be found. And Kurz yesterday promised to talk to all the parties. And there are several options for coalitions. But coalition always means compromise that he will have to turn around in many ways. If there should in any way be an overlap either with Greens or Social Democrats. That is why I said I couldn't predict, but sort of a speculation. My speculation right now is there will be long negotiations which will not work because there will be no consensus about environment, about education, about migration, about NGOs, about refugees, all that with the Greens. And with the Socialists, there will be no consensus about trade unions, about working hours, labor laws and gender politics. And so then Kurz will at one point say, well, I've tried it very hard, but what else can I do now? Then go with blue again. And that will be in the early spring. So until then, blue will have had time to reconcile and, you know, put themselves on their feet again. And I think it's possible that that happens, that we either Austria gets black and blue or turquoise blue again, or that there would be a minority government with the support of blue. Now, that was already yesterday offered by one of the gurus of the Blue Party, Andreas Mölzer, who is the ideologue of the FPÖ and was on television in a debate, and already said, well, you know, that would be possible. So we're
Austria
stuck.
May well be heading again for another very right-wing government.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult. I think it would be very good for Austria if we would have black and green or black and red again, because then this far-right Kurz politics would have to change, because he wouldn't be able to do that.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. The podcast is going from strength to strength, with more regular shows, more listeners, and great guests. But this all takes money and resources. That's why we've introduced extra time for paid-up members of Another Europe Is Possible. To join the campaign, just go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, I ask Ruth about the implications for Europe, as a new poll last week put the German Greens on 27%, and there is much talk of a future Green-CDU coalition. We discuss the parallels between Austria and Germany. To feed back to us on the podcast, you can contact us on podcast@anothereurope.org. We'd be grateful for ideas for new shows and content. You can also support the podcast by just telling someone about it. Go to your podcast platform and leave a rating or review. Thanks for listening. We'll be back very soon. See you then. In Germany, in the last week or so, an opinion poll has come out putting the German Greens at extraordinary level of support, level pegging with the CDU at 27% each. So, although you say it's unlikely, the possibility in the not-too-distant future, because German politics is very unstable and the coalition might fall, there might be early elections, and you could easily imagine a kind of grand coalition, but not like the one we're used to, yeah, but the one involving the CDU and the Greens in Germany is being widely talked about. And then in Austria, you might have still, although you say it's unlikely, a coalition between the centre-right and the Greens there. Would be an interesting moment for Europe if that happened. I fear it would be quite bad in the end for the Greens, because you could imagine them pulling them too far to the right.
It would depend, because Germany is in a very special situation right now, because it's Merkel's period is coming to an end. In any case, whenever the next election will be, she will not stand again. She took the CDU very far to the center left, which is why the Social Democrats have lost totally, because actually much legislation proposed by the Social Democrats was implemented, but she got the bonus. And so many Social Democrats have gone to the Greens, which has happened in Vienna now as well. But there's a big difference between CDU and CSU. And Kurz is much more on CSU. Kurz's friend is in Bavaria, not Merkel. Kurz has always been very oppositional to Merkel, both on the European stage, but also in bilateral, because of the refugee movement and because of migration policies. So there, Kurz is much more far right than the CDU is. So that is still, again, very different.
Yeah.
And the German Greens used to be very left-wing. Now Habeck, I think is his name, is very pragmatic. And, of course, German has the big threat of the AfD, which has not yet gone through the whole cycle like the FPÖ. Right now they are rising. and everybody's afraid of the AfD, but there is a sort of cordon sanitaire. Yeah? Nobody wants to form a coalition with the AfD. And that's also very different from Austria.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, it's difficult to say what happens in Germany will happen in Austria because the whole context is so different.
And Kurz has clearly taken the centre-right in Austria quite a lot further to the right from your description, right? I mean, I find it, when I was here, interesting that you would often meet people on the Austrian centre-right who were by no means right-wing. I mean, in fact, you know, one person I'm thinking of in particular, you know, joked at a meeting I was at that where, you know, in America I'd be considered a socialist, but in Europe I'm a Christian Democrat. That's like kind of the traditional Austrian centre-right. I mean, those people must feel very disenfranchised within their own party from this administration. Is there not more contestation argument about the future of the Austrian centre-right, or is Kurz just, he's bringing in the votes, so we support him?
Well, there is ambivalence, but not very noisy ambivalence. There were some voices, just to mention, for example, Fischler, who had been commissioner for Austria, very well-known Christian social Tyrolean. And there have been voices from Vorarlberg, from the regional governor, and from Tyrol, and from Salzburg. So all these regions which are still define themselves as Christian social, and there have been voices who said this party is not Christian enough anymore, we cannot sort of support €1.50 per hour salary for migrants and similar proposals which the Freedom Party and Kurz suggested and also wanted to implement or really implement it. So there was protest, but as long as you have power, I think it's difficult to sort of leave that power and to say I'm standing with my principles against this power, something we see with the Republicans and Donald Trump. I mean, Jan Werner Müller has written quite a lot about that, that it's appalling, as he says, that so many Republicans still stand with Trump in spite of not only the lies, but the really big, dangerous policies which are happening there. But obviously power corrupts, and the same is happening here. So as long as Kurz is sort of this quote-unquote darling of many voters, especially elderly women who seem to really love him, and also constructing himself as a savior. There was this one episode in the summer in the biggest concert hall in Vienna, in the Stadthalle, where Kurz was invited by evangelicals with an Australian head to come, and they were praying for him. And he was then asked to come on stage, and this leader of this evangelical movement then said a prayer for Kurz and how wonderful it was that this was this leader and politician in Austria, and there were 10,000 people praying for Kurz. Now, Austria is a secular country. I mean, we have a independent politics from the church in almost all levels, not quite, yeah? So this sort of staging as the savior, you're almost God-sent savior, yeah? I really think irritated very many people of the old tradition of the Volkspartei. But nobody really came out too loudly about it. And even now in September during the election campaign, there were a few videos from NGO which called themselves the Anständigen Konservativen. The so-called upright conservatives were ÖVP voters, former doctors, managers, also young managers, came out with their name and said, I'm not going to vote Kurz anymore because... got a lot of clicks, 400,000, 500,000, because there were these people. But still, that was completely overwhelmed by the propaganda.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me, Ruth. It's been a pleasure as ever. And, well, we wish Austria luck. I'm sure you will wish Britain luck.
I wish Britain a lot of luck, having been A, born there, and B, worked there, and having many friends there. I watch it very intensely.
Yeah, and we're not in such a good way.
No. And we will see what happens here. I think it's very difficult to predict, but there are some tendencies which we can pick out.
Yeah, the whole point of these conversations is that we strengthen the international solidarity and learning about one another's situation, isn't it? That's such a condition for working together and campaigning together.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, as ever, for talking to us.
Thank you.